Tynan.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Monica Tynan, and I represent the defendant Stanley Algy in this case. This case involves major constitutional violations of double jeopardy and due process. We have here a defendant who was unsuccessfully prosecuted by the state on at least four prior occasions. Each of those prosecutions involved prosecutors who were also involved in the federal case. In fact, the U.S. attorney in this case and the defendant go way back. Back when he was the Jackson County State's attorney, the U.S. attorney for this case actually visited the defendant in prison while he was awaiting trial on one of these earlier state charges. However, during this visit, the defendant did not have the benefit of his lawyer. The defendant didn't have his lawyer present because the U.S. attorney failed to notify the defendant's lawyer on purpose. The U.S. attorney has admitted that during this so-called plea meeting, he ended up swearing at the defendant and pounding his fist on the table in an effort to extract a plea agreement. When the defendant refused to enter into a plea agreement, the U.S. attorney ended up swearing at him in response to the defendant's audacity to exercise his constitutional rights to proceed to trial on those charges. Now, moments after the last unsuccessful state prosecution was reversed on appeal, the U.S. attorney filed the charges against the defendant in this case. Which U.S. attorney? The same U.S. attorney that was the former Jackson County State's attorney who was unsuccessful on at least four prior occasions in convicting the defendant. Given the time we have to argue today, I'd like to highlight three key issues of the defendant's appeal. First is the prosecution of the defendant was barred by double jeopardy. Count three of the superseding indictment was impermissibly broadened, and the sentence on count one is unconstitutional. Turning to double jeopardy. When one sovereign uses another sovereign as a tool to bring a successive prosecution, that second prosecution is a sham and a cover for the first prosecution, and it's impermissible under the double jeopardy clause. When the two prosecuting authorities are so intertwined that they are really one sovereign prosecuting the defendant twice, there exists a double jeopardy violation. Now, the dual sovereignty doctrine does permit successive state and federal prosecutions, but there is an exception to the dual sovereignty doctrine, and that exception exists for the precise reasons that are before this court today. This court has held that that exception applies when the federal prosecutors are puppets of the state prosecutors. In this
case, the federal prosecution is for different crimes than the state, isn't it?
Some are similar and some are different. The initial indictment charged the defendant with two gun charges that were at issue in the state and arose out of the exact same incident that was at issue in the state, which is the 1996 home invasion. The superseding indictment did add two drug conspiracy charges, a marijuana conspiracy, which also arose out of the same incident at issue in the state case, and an additional crack conspiracy. Many of the witnesses who testified against the defendant on the crack count were the same witnesses who testified against the defendant on the marijuana conspiracy and on the two gun charges. Now, the federal prosecutors in this state were more than mere puppets of the state prosecutors. They were the exact same prosecutors. Additional facts.
How large a county are we dealing with here, Ms. Stein?
Pardon me?
How large a county are we dealing with? This is a former state prosecutor.
How big is the population of Jackson County?
Yeah, I mean, I just, wonder whether or not we're dealing with a kind of a smaller legal community than we might be in Milwaukee or Chicago.
Certainly Jackson County is smaller than Cook County, and the U.S. attorney, who was the former Jackson County State's attorney, admitted in the lower court that he and the defendant knew each other. They were both from the same area, and clearly they had a lengthy history given the numerous unsuccessful prosecutions.
What if we had, not a prosecutor, but we had a former deputy sheriff who became a state police officer? Is that the same situation? They did that different jurisdiction, but he arrested him in one uniform and then arrested him later in another uniform. Is that the kind of concerns you have here?
Well, the issue is whether the two sovereigns are so intertwined that they are actually, one, charging the defendant twice
but
for the
same
crime.
But the sovereign isn't the individual. He's left the sovereign.
However, he represents the office of the state's attorney.
That's not the same government. You've got one individual who was a state official, leaves the state, then becomes a federal official. That doesn't make it one sovereign prosecuting.
Well, it does when they are so intertwined because they're using the resources.
Well, what would you suggest we look to? And that's why I referenced the size of the community. Would you suggest we ought to have a bar to service in both sovereigns and then involvement with a single criminal defendant?
I don't know if there's a threshold you can look to. You just need to look to the standard of whether, as this court has set forth, if there's the puppets of the state, if the former sheriff, as you say, moved over and...
You can stay with your case. you don't have to take my hypothetical.
Well, in this case, it's clear that they were one sovereign prosecuting the defendant twice.
Well, again, if you use your puppet example, it doesn't work, does it? How do you be a puppet to yourself? That's kind of hard to imagine.
Well, you can be the puppet to other people who formerly worked for you in the Jackson County State's Attorney and then move over to the U.S. Attorney.
That gets back to Judge Flom's question. Do you want to have an absolute rule that you can't ever have people move from the state to the federal because there'll be a constant conflict? In small legal communities, that happens all the time, doesn't it?
Well, when they're bringing charges for the exact same offense, that's where the double jeopardy...
Not the exact same offense, though. That was the point I made earlier, isn't it? Some of it is the charges are related, but some of it they're unrelated.
Right. The original ones were related, and then the superseding indictment was brought that added the conspiracy charges. Double jeopardy violation in this case is further evidenced by the nature of the prosecution. The prosecution in this case was clearly vindictive. The prosecution is vindictive if it is done in retaliation for the defendant's exercise of his constitutional rights, and is therefore unconstitutional under the Due Process Clause. In this case, there exists a realistic likelihood of vindictiveness. Two factors need to be examined: whether the prosecutors had a stake in deterring some exercise of a constitutional right. The more significant stake, the more likely the prosecution was vindictive. Additionally, the prosecutor's conduct needs to be analyzed. Did the prosecutors demonstrate a genuine animus toward the defendant? In this case, the prosecutors clearly had a stake in finally convicting this defendant. They lost on numerous occasions and needed to be vindicated. They both demonstrated a genuine animus toward the defendant. The U.S. attorney who was a former Jackson County State's attorney, clearly demonstrated his animus when he went to visit the defendant in jail without the defendant's lawyer, didn't even notify the lawyer, ended up swearing at him and pounding his fist at the table because he couldn't extract a plea agreement, and in retaliation for the defendant's exercise of his constitutional right to go to trial.
When did he disqualify himself from this prosecution?
Well, the claims of the U.S. attorney's recusal, I think, are simply implausible, and they're unsupported by the record. So there's no recusal. The trial attorney in this case clearly demonstrated her animus toward the defendant by making personal attacks on the defendant during sentencing, which were unrelated to sentencing, and by repeatedly referencing state charges of which the defendant had clearly been exonerated. Additionally, there was
He wasn't exactly exonerated, was he? That his conviction was reversed for violation of the Speedy Trial Act.
That was just one of the
conditions. Is that an exoneration in your view?
Well, there were references to an earlier murder charge, which he was acquitted, and an aggravated battery.
How many prior convictions did he have?
That were reversed on appeal, or that?
No, I mean that were not reversed.
I think he may have had two earlier ones. I believe there was a traffic offense and a drug.
And drug.
And drug. Count 3 of the superseding indictment was impermissibly broadened in this case. Count 3 specifically lists a Norinco SKS semi-automatic rifle and a Victor .22 caliber revolver. These are the weapons the defendant was charged with knowingly possessing in violation of Section 922G. The district court instructed the jury that they should convict the defendant on count three if they found that he knowingly possessed a firearm rather than the two specific guns charged in the indictment.
The language of the indictment here is "that is." Is that right? That is.
Pardon me?
The language of the indictment here uses the conjunction "that is." Is that correct? That
I believe
he lists
so.
The charge, and then it says "that is," and it gives
and
the specifics
two
of these.
Correct.
Yeah. And your position is that's closer to it, which is one of the precedents, than it is to including, which is another precedent. Is that correct?
Right. The Lightman case that you refer to?
Well, he's two. Yeah, the one of them is Lightman and the other is Goins. One of them talks about to it and the other talks about including. And your position is that is closer to it than it is to including. Isn't that
correct?
All this boils down to?
Well, when the government chose to frame its indictment specifically by listing these two specific guns in count three, you'll notice count four does not have specific guns listed, and then introduced evidence of three additional guns at trial, the district court should have instructed the jury that they needed to find the defendant knowingly possessed those two specific guns. The court's instruction failed to convey the correct message to the jury reasonably well, as Dawson versus New York Life holds, and therefore was misleading and prejudiced the defendant. An indictment can only be amended if it's resubmitted to the grand jury. The indictment in this case was not resubmitted to the grand jury. It was not narrowed and it was not corrected, both of which are permitted. The indictment in this case was impermissibly broadened because it presented more and different offenses to the jury on which the defendant could be convicted.
Ms. Stein, did you want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes.
I don't want to cut you off. I just want
to.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Robertson?
Thank you. I please the court. My name is Amanda Robertson. I represent the Appalachian United States. In response to the defendant's arguments in this case, first, as we point out in our brief, there are two arguments that are legally inconsistent, the vindictive prosecution and the double jeopardy. They start out their argument by saying this case was driven by W. Charles Grace's vindictiveness, his improper animus against the defendant. This case was driven by Charles Grace. That's what they need to succeed on the vindictive prosecution. But when they're arguing double jeopardy, they're saying Jackson County State's Attorney Mike Webstick was the driving force, and that W. Charles Grace, the then U.S. Attorney, was merely the puppet of the state. And as we pointed out, those are inconsistent legally and factually, and neither of them are correct.
It also suggests then that the assistant is in charge of the office rather than the U.S. Attorney, right?
Well, Your Honor, in the United States brought these charges, and in arguments, defense counsel just indicated that there was the recusal was somewhat suspect and that it was totally unsupported by the record. And I ask the court to note that all of the documents, besides the recusal of Mr. Grace, all the documents, the first assistant, Robert Simpkins, supervised the prosecution in this case on behalf of the United States. All filings are in Robert Simpkins' name, not in Mr. Charles Grace's. And when defense counsel was serving documents on the United States, they were serving Robert Simpkins and not Charles Grace. So we certainly disagree with the statement that the recusal, which we believe was unnecessary, we do believe there was a recusal and that it is supported
who,
by the
who
record.
Presented, does the record reflect who presented the case to the grand jury?
There were grand jury transcripts in this case which were ultimately turned over, and those would indicate that I was the assistant United States attorney who tried the case and presented the entire case to the grand jury. As to defense counsel indicating that the I had a vindictiveness or an improper animus against the defendant, there's nothing in the record to support that. And part of the problem with the vindictive prosecution argument is it wasn't raised in the district court. Because it wasn't raised in the district court, we weren't allowed to, if they came forward with objective evidence, which I don't believe they would have, if they had raised it, we would have had the opportunity to rebut it. Because it was not raised until appeal, now we're kind of in the situation where we have to rebut it, even though we don't believe they've presented objective evidence, we have to rebut it with a record where it wasn't raised.
Could you give us an idea that Judge Flom raised this earlier about Jackson County, the legal community, the size of the area, what we're talking about here?
Jackson County would be one of the more populous counties in the Southern District. Southern Illinois University in Carbondale is located there.
Populous, how many people in the bar?
Your Honor, I apologize. I don't know. It's going to be one of the bigger counties. It's got a law school in the county. People stay around. But it's not unusual for a state's attorney to become a United States attorney, especially in the Southern District of Illinois. Regarding the vindictive prosecution case, the defendant's argument kind of boils down to no prosecutor that unsuccessfully prosecutes a defendant can later prosecute that defendant. Just because the Jackson County State's Attorney's Office might have lost some cases where the defendant was was involved doesn't mean necessarily that there's animus there. And defense fails to point out that that same State's Attorney's Office did successfully prosecute Stan Algie on a 1988 distribution of controlled substance. He was sentenced to 10 years on that count. Didn't get out till 94 and immediately got back into the drug business.
Is there an inherent problem if there is a not guilty verdict, a reversal on appeal of a state case, and the federal government then prosecutes other crimes that were related, grew out of the same incident?
No, Your Honor. The dual separate sovereigns, there is not. And I would argue that if you look at the record, three of these counts arose out of the December 18, 1996 Grand Tower offense. But none of them are the exact same offense. It's my recollection that even the unlawful possession of weapon by a felon in the state had to do with Mr. Algie possessing a knife as opposed to it was the other two individuals who went
with the state prosecution did not involve drugs. Is that
not at all, Your Honor.
What about the comment relating to Mr. Grace's conduct concerning contact with the defendant outside the presence of his lawyer?
Just to clarify the record, that was not in this case. That was back
I
in
understand not
the early case. 90s, and I believe what the record would indicate is that Mr. Algie had been convicted of a unlawful distribution case, and he was coming to trial on a homicide, armed robbery case. Mr. Grace admitted that he did go speak with the defendant to find out if the defendant was going to accept the plea offer or not. The defendant did accept the plea offer. And
was he represented by counsel at the time he
contacted? Yes, he was, Your Honor. And Mr. Grace admitted that his conduct was improper. The defendant pled guilty, was sentenced, I believe, to 45 or 49 years on that armed robbery homicide case. Mr. Algie moved to withdraw the guilty plea in the state court. It was denied. It went up on appeal. On appeal, the Fifth District Appellate Court found that it noted Mr. Grace's conduct, said it wasn't prudent, excuse me, but did not reverse based on that. He reversed based on the fact that Mr. Algie had not been properly represented by his defense attorney, and that the defense attorney improperly told Mr. Algie what he was looking at. So the plea was invalidated because it was not a voluntary plea. It was not invalidated because Mr. Grace acted imprudently. But as I said, in this case, Mr. Grace felt it proper to recuse himself, even though probably legally it was not necessary. In response,
at what point did he exercise that recusal, Travis?
Your Honor, the recusal form is signed, and it's in the record. I don't have it below before me. I believe it was in February at the time of the indictment. There's no filing. The initial indictment in this case has Mr. Simpson's name on first assistant.
Would you like to get some water?
Thank you. Regarding Justice Flom's question about the prior convictions of the defendant, there were two prior 1980 unlawful delivery of controlled substance and a 1988 unlawful delivery of controlled substance and a few traffic. One of the instances that's used that I showed a personal attack on the defendant is by filing a motion for upward departure at sentencing. Clearly, that's provided for in the sentencing guidelines, and what the United States believes is criminal history category 3, significantly underrepresented the significance of this defendant's past. That being, he had the two 1980 felony drug convictions where he got no points. We were prepared to prove by preponderance of the evidence an aggravated battery, a homicide, and a robbery, of which he was didn't receive criminal history points. And clearly, all of those are provided for in the guidelines, and the United States does not see how doing what you are allowed to do could be perceived as improper motive and improper animus.
His attorney was disqualified at the state trial, Christensen?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was that disqualification about?
That disqualification was because he had represented co-defendant Battles in the same case.
Yeah. But he represented LG on appeal, though.
Yes, and no one is clear how that occurred, but clearly he did reenter his appearance on appeal and did that. And one thing I would like to point out on the disqualification issue, what the defense fails to mention is that co-defendant Battles filed a motion to disqualify Algie's attorney. I certainly think that that is significant. This is not just a case where the government thought that the defense attorney should be disqualified. Co-counsel Battles filed a motion to disqualify, said, I won't waive my attorney-client privilege with Mr. Christensen. I don't want him cross-examining me. I'm moving to disqualify him. And when Judge Foreman granted the motion to disqualify, he granted both co-defendant Battles' motion and the government's motion. Regarding the count 3 broadening of the indictment, would argue, first of all, it's waived. That was not raised. The jury instruction was not objected to. And if you look at the argument in this case, clearly the argument was that count 3 went to the Victor 22 revolver and the Narenko SKF. It could not have been any clearer.
Yeah, these two precedents seem to turn on the language of the indictment, don't they? Used the language, what? To wit, and Goins said, use the...
That including.
Including. And the language of this indictment is that is. Now, that is closer to wit than
right.
Is to including.
That is in the middle, closer to wit.
How is it any different than to wit? It seems to me it's
it is similar to wit, Your Honor. But if you look at the argument, it supports that those guns went to that count. The argument could not have been any clearer. And the Lightman case, which is the leading case, which is the two wit, the United States did not argue waiver in that case. And this court pretty much indicated had the government argued waiver, the defendant was not going to succeed. But because the government did not argue waiver, the defendant prevailed. And in this case, clearly we are arguing waiver. So we believe the Lightman case is distinguishable. Regarding Apprendi, this court has repeatedly found 20 years can never be violative of Apprendi in a crack cocaine case because 20 years is the default statutory maximum. The defendant got 20 years. The defense keeps saying, well, there's a 10-year difference between the mandatory minimum, and that's not the case because the guideline range, which the defendant doesn't acknowledge, the guideline range is 235 to 293 months. So we're talking about a 5-month difference and not a 10-month difference. All the cases indicate Apprendi does not apply to mandatory minimum. The 20-year sentence was appropriate. For these reasons, we'd ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Robertson. Ms. Dines?
Quickly go back to one earlier argument. We're not arguing that no prosecutor can ever bring charges against a defendant if they have failed to successfully prosecute him in the earlier case. We're arguing that these prosecutors clearly demonstrated a vindictive motive and they brought these charges in retaliation against the defendant for exercising his constitutional rights.
And what should we look to in this case for that? If we exclude Mr. Gray, what's the evidence of vindictiveness other than the act of the charging him again?
The fact that the prosecutor had a stake in the outcome. And
stake in what sense? That he lost the case before, you mean?
That they lost four previous cases, and because the defendant exercised his constitutional right. Defendants need to be free of the apprehension of retaliatory conduct on the part of the prosecutor.
You're suggesting Mr. Grace remains in the picture.
Absolutely.
Despite the recusal.
Well, I think the recusal is implausible. There's nothing in the record to support that.
Well, that,
the recusal
that may be,
manual.
But wouldn't it help? Wouldn't it have helped if we had some sort of record below on this issue?
Yes, and it wasn't raised in the lower court. Well, the recusal, first of all, wasn't an issue because that was not filed in the record. That was appended to this record.
Well, but it is true, is it not, that Mr. Shimkus returned the indictment, had the indictment returned, I mean.
I believe his signature is on the form.
Right. So, I mean, that would seem to support that Mr. Grace was out of the picture?
I think it's implausible given the fact that the indictment was returned just a few short days after the state conviction was reversed on appeal. To think that he had no part in it is unbelievable.
Yeah, but see, I don't want to quarrel with you, but that jump or that leap of faith or that deduction you want us to make is one that comes from, you know, your reflection on this record, not on a record below.
That's true, and it was the government's burden to rebut the presumption of vindictiveness and to bring forth...
So the presumption exists just because of these facts.
The
and so the defense did not need to raise this as an issue at the trial level.
It's clearly reviewable for plain error.
All right.
See that my time is up. We ask that you
reverse.
Well,
not quite. You've got a little time.
We ask that you reverse the defendant's convictions on all four counts, and in the alternative, on count one, that his unconstitutional sentence be vacated and remanded for resentencing in accordance with the Palmer case.
Well, our thanks to all counsel, and a particular thanks. On behalf of the court, Ms. Tynan, to you and the firm for accepting this appointment and ably presenting the argument.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Garippo. Thank you also.